Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Meditation and Kabbalah by Aria Kaplan. Narrated by Josh Bloomberg. Publisher's Note. In this audio edition, you will hear references to visual material present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Introduction. It is with great trepidation that one begins to write a work such as this, involving some of the most hidden mysteries of the Kabbalah. Many would question the wisdom and propriety of placing such information in a printed book, especially in an English translation. But so much misinformation has already been published that it is virtually imperative that an authentic, authoritative account be published. It is for this reason, as well as other reasons which I am bound by an oath to conceal, that the great living masters of Kabbalah have voiced their approval that such a book be published. The science of Kabbalah is divided into three basic areas: the theoretical, the meditative, and the practical. The theoretical deals with the form of the mysteries, teaching the structure of the angelic domains, as well as of the spherot, or divine emanations. With great success, it deals with problems posed by the many schools of philosophy, and it provides a conceptual framework into which all theological ideas can be fitted. More important for the discussion at hand, it also provides a framework through which the mechanism of both the meditative and practical Kabbalah can be understood. Some 3,000 Kabbalah texts exist in print, and for the most part, the vast majority deal with the theoretical Kabbalah. Falling within this category are the best-known Kabbalah works, such as the Zohar and the Bahir, which are almost totally theoretical in their scope. The same is true of the writings of Rabbi Isaac Luria, the Ari, considered by many to have been the greatest of all Kabbalists. With the passage of time, this school probed deeper and deeper into the philosophical ramifications of the primary Kabbalistic concepts, producing an extremely profound, self-consistent, and satisfying philosophical system. The practical Kabbalah, on the other hand, was a kind of white magic, dealing with the use of techniques that could evoke supernatural powers. It involved the use of divine names and incantations, amulets and talismans, as well as chiromancy, physiognomy, and astrology. Many theoretical Kabbalists, led by the Ari, frowned on the use of such techniques, labeling them as dangerous and spiritually demeaning. As a result, only a very small number of texts have survived at all, mostly in manuscript form, and only a handful of the most innocuous of these have been published. It is significant to note that a number of techniques alluded to in these fragments also appear to have been preserved among the non-Jewish school of magic in Europe. The relationship between the practical Kabbalah and these magical schools would constitute an interesting area of study. The meditative Kabbalah stands between these two extremes. Some of the earliest meditative methods border on the practical Kabbalah, and their use is discouraged by the latter masters, especially those of the Ari's school. Within this category are the few surviving texts from the Talmudic period. The same is true of the teachings of the 13th century master Rabbi Abraham Abulafia, whose meditative works have never been printed and survive only in manuscript. Most telling is a statement at the end of Sha'arei Kedusha, Gates of Holiness, which is essentially a meditative manual. The most important and explicit part of this text is the fourth section, which actually provides instructions in meditation. When this book was first printed in 1715, the publisher omitted this last, most important section, with the following note. The printer declares that this fourth section is not to be copied or printed, since it consists entirely of divine names, permutations, and concealed mysteries, and it is not proper to bring them on the altar of the printing press. Actually, upon examining this section, we find that divine names and permutations play a relatively small role, and could easily have been omitted. But besides this, the section in question also presents explicit instructions for the various techniques of Kabbalah meditation, and even this was considered too secret a doctrine to be published for the masses. The Ari himself also made use of a system of meditation involving yichudim, unifications, and this was included in the main body of his writings, particularly in the Shar Ruach HaKodesh, Gate of the Holy Spirit. But even here, it is significant to note that, although the Ari lived in the 16th century, this text was not printed until 1863. For over 300 years, it was available only in manuscript. With the spread of the Hasidic movement in the 18th century, a number of meditative techniques became more popular, especially those centered around the formal prayer service. This reached its zenith in the teachings of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, who discusses meditation in considerable length. He developed a system that could be used by the masses, and it was primarily for this reason that Rabbi Nachman's teachings met with much harsh opposition. One of the problems in discussing meditation, either in Hebrew or in English, is the fact that there exists only a very limited vocabulary with which to express the various technical terms. For the sake of clarity, a number of such terms, such as mantra and mandala, have been borrowed from the various meditative systems of the East. This is not meant in any way to imply that there is any connection or relationship between these systems and the Kabbalah. Terms such as these are used only because there are no Western equivalents. Since they are familiar to most contemporary listeners, they have the advantage of making the text more readily understood. Many people express surprise that the Jewish tradition contains a formal meditative system that, at least in its outward manifestations, does resemble some of the Eastern systems. This resemblance was first noted in the Zohar, which recognized the merit of the Eastern systems, but warned against their use. The fact that different systems resemble each other is only a reflection on the veracity of the technique, which is primarily one of spiritual liberation. The fact that other religions make use of it is of no more consequence than the fact that they also engage in prayer and worship. This does not make Jewish worship and prayer any less meaningful or unique, and the same is true of meditation. It is basically a technique for releasing oneself from the bonds of one's physical nature. Where one goes from there depends very much on the system used. Chapter 1. Meditation. 1. The Schools. It is universally accepted by the Kabbalists that the first ones to engage in these meditative methods were the patriarchs and prophets, who used them to attain enlightenment and prophecy. Although there are many allusions to this in the Bible, the scripture is virtually silent when it comes to providing explicit descriptions of their methods. Still, if one looks at the appropriate texts, one can gain considerable insight into the methods that were in use in the time of the prophets. The earliest direct statement regarding method comes from the first century, from the early Talmudic period. Here, we find some of the greatest Talmudists engaged in the mystical arts, making use of a number of meditative techniques to attain spiritual elevation and ascend to the transcendental realm. Many of these techniques consisted of the repetition of divine names, as well as intense concentration on the transcendental spheres. What little we know of their methods is preserved in a few fragments, as well in a remarkable complete text, Hechalot Rabbatai, the Greater Chambers, of which the main parts are presented for the first time in translation in this book. It was during this period that some of the main classics of Kabbalah were written. These include the Sefer Yetzirah, Book of Formation, the Bahir, and the Zohar. These involved even higher levels than those described in the Hechalot, and for the most part, only the barest hints are provided as to how these levels were reached. With the close of the Talmudic period, these methods became restricted to a few very small closed secret societies. Both the Bahir and the Zohar remained completely unknown outside of these societies, and were not revealed until the late 12th and 13th centuries, respectively. The publication of the Bahir in particular gave impetus to the study of the mysteries, and a number of individuals began to openly teach the secret methods. Most remarkable among these was Rabbi Abraham Abu Lafia. Having received the tradition from earlier sources, he was the first to actually put them in writing. For this, he was condemned in many circles, although most Kabbalists consider his methods to be authentic and based on a reliable tradition. Several of his contemporaries, most notably Rabbi Isaac of Akko and Rabbi Joseph Gigatalia, also speak of meditative methods. Most of their work, however, was eclipsed by the publication of the Zohar in the middle 1290s. This great classic gripped the imagination of almost all Kabbalists of the time, and the teachings of other schools was virtually forgotten. It is therefore no accident that many books written before this were never published, and among those which have not been lost, a good number exist only in manuscript. Since the Zohar has little to say about meditative methods, many important Kabbalists began to ignore the subject completely. They were too involved in trying to unravel the mysteries of this ancient book that had been concealed for many centuries. There were a few exceptions, however, and these Kabbalists made use of the methods of Abu Lafia, Gigatalia, and Isaac of Akko. For over 200 years, however, we find virtually nobody exploring the Zohar itself to ascertain the meditative methods used by its authors. The main attempts in this direction occurred in the Tzfat school, which flourished during the 16th century. It reached its zenith in the teachings of Rabbi Isaac Luria, commonly known as the Ari, who showed how the various letter combinations found in the Zohar were actually meant to be used as meditative devices. Although the Ari wrote almost nothing himself, his teachings were arduously copied by his disciples and fill almost 24 large volumes. To a large extent, all this was an introduction to the methodology involved in his system of meditation. Just as the Zohar had overshadowed everything when it was published, so did the writings of the Ari overwhelm the other schools 3 centuries later. His teachings were seen as the ultimate expression of the Kabbalah, and for the next 200 years, the greatest part of Kabbalah literature devoted itself to their interpretation. Although the Ari's meditative methods were used by a few individuals, and possibly by 1 or 2 minor schools, for the most part, the Kabbalists devoted themselves to theory rather than practice. The next great renaissance came with the rise of the Hasidic movement, founded by Rabbi Israel, the Baal Shem Tov. When their works are studied, it becomes obvious that the Baal Shem and his closest disciples were ardent students of the earlier meditative texts of the Kabbalah, and in the Hasidic classics, these texts are often paraphrased. During the second half of the 18th century, and perhaps the first decade or two of the 19th, many people engaged in the classical meditative techniques of Kabbalah, often describing the high spiritual states that they attained. The opposition to this, especially where it involved teaching these methods to the masses, was very strong. An entire group, known as the Mitnagdim, opposers, arose to combat the Hasidim, vigorously denouncing their methods. As a result, the Hasidim themselves began to de-emphasize their meditative practices, and eventually, these were virtually forgotten. 2. Methods. Meditation is primarily a means of attaining spiritual liberation. Its various methods are designated to loosen the bond of the physical, allowing the individual to ascend to the transcendental, spiritual realm. One who accomplishes this successfully is said to have attained Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit, which is the general Hebraic term for enlightenment. The best known contemporary method of meditation is that which involves a mantra, a word or phrase that is repeated over and over for a designated period of time. One concentrates on the mantra to the exclusion of all else, thus clearing the mind of all extraneous thoughts and divorcing it from the normal stream of consciousness. In this method, the mantra may be repeated verbally, or the repetition may be completely mental. This type of meditation is found in the Kabbalah, especially among the earlier schools. In the Hechalot, for example, one begins his spiritual ascent by repeating a number of divine names 112 times. Mantra meditation is an example of structured, externally directed meditation. It is externally directed, insofar as one concentrates on a word or phrase, rather than on the spontaneous thoughts to the mind. Since it involves a specific practice, repeated for a fixed length of time, it is considered a structured meditation. Another example of structured, externally directed meditation is contemplation, where one gazes at an object, placing all of one's concentration on it. In occult practices, the best-known type of contemplation involves gazing into a crystal ball. Other types of contemplation involve mandalas, pictures or letter designs, where one gazes upon them, emptying the mind of all other thought. In Kabbalah meditation, the simplest contemplative device is the tetragrammaton itself, and this is discussed even in non-Kabbalistic works. More complex forms are also used, and this method seems to have reached its zenith under the influence of Rabbi Shalom Sharabi. Very closely related to this is the method of Yichudim, unifications, which plays an important role in the system of the Ari. Here, one does not contemplate a physical picture, but rather a mental image, usually consisting of various combinations of divine names. Since the structures and combinations of these names are predetermined and do not arise spontaneously in the mind, this is also considered to be an externally directed meditation. The second basic method of meditation is that which is internally directed. This consists of meditating on thoughts, feelings, or mental images that arise spontaneously in the mind. Usually, this is best accomplished by focusing on a general area around which these thoughts will be evoked. Since there is no formal or predetermined method of evoking such thoughts, this is most commonly an unstructured meditation. Internally directed meditation can be practiced purely in thought, or, as in some systems, one's thoughts can also be verbalized. One of the best methods of verbalizing such thoughts while keeping them concentrated on a single focus is to express them as spontaneous prayer. It is this method that forms the basis for the meditative system of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. The third basic type of meditation is that which is non-directed. Such meditation strives for a stillness of the mind and a withdrawal from all perception, both internal and external. It plays an important role in the advanced states of many other methods, but at the same time, it can also be used as a method in its own right. Very little is expressly written about this method, but it appears to play a role in the teachings of such Hasidic masters as Rabbi Dov Ber, the Maggid of Mezrich, and Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev. There is evidence that this method was used, at least for the most advanced, in the very terminology of the Kabbalah. Indeed, in a number of cases, it is only when looked upon in this sense that some terminology is comprehensible. Thus, for example, the Kabbalists call the highest level of transcendence Ein, literally, nothingness. Actually, this alludes to the ultimate level reached by non-directed meditation, where all perception and imagery cease to exist. Besides being divided into these three basic methods, meditation can be classified according to the means used. The three basic means are the intellect, the emotions, and the body. The path of the intellect is very prevalent among the theoretical Kabbalists, and was also used outside of the Kabbalistic schools. The most common method was simply to contemplate on various aspects of the Torah, probing the inner meaning of its commandments. It also included delving deeply with the intellect into the structure of the supernal universes, and, as it were, becoming a denizen of these worlds. For many, this method led to a very high state of ecstasy. And this method forms the basis of the Chabad system of Hasidism. Another form of intellectual meditation involves the study of devotional works, carefully contemplating each concept in an effort to attain self-improvement. It was primarily this method that formed the basis of the Musar movement, which arose in the 19th century as a response to Hasidism. Such contemplation, or hitboninut, plays an especially important role in the devotional work Misilat Yesharim, Path of the Just, by the great Kabbalist Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. In this remarkable book, the author outlines all the steps leading up to, but not including, Ruach HaKodesh, the ultimate enlightenment. The method of attaining these desired traits is that of hitboninut, contemplation on the teachings germane to that step, and rectifying one's life in the light of these teachings. Incidentally, although it is not widely known, the 10 levels discussed in this text clearly parallel the 10 mystical sfirot of the Kabbalists. The path of the emotions also plays an important role in the systems of the Kabbalists. One place where it is particularly important is in Kavana meditation, the system that makes use of the formal daily prayers as a sort of mantra, especially in the Hasidic schools. Here, one is taught to place all of his feelings and emotions into the words of his worship, thus attaining a divestment of the physical, hitpashtut hagashmiut. This path is also found in meditations involving music, which played an important role in the meditations of the ancient prophets of the Bible. A path combining the intellect and emotions is the path of love, described in detail by the leading philosopher Rabbi Moses Maimonides. He writes that when a person deeply contemplates on God, thinking of his mighty deeds and wondrous creations, he becomes profoundly aware of his wisdom and is brought to a passionate love for God. He speaks of a level of love called cheshek, passion, where the emotion is so intense that every thought is exclusively engaged with its object. This love for God can be so intense that the soul can literally be drawn out of the body by it, and this is what occurs when a saint dies by the kiss of God. This is considered to be one of the highest possible levels of enlightenment, usually attained only at very advanced age. The third path is that of the body. It includes both the body motions and breathing exercises that play a key role in the system of Rabbi Abraham Abulafia. The swaying and bowing that accompanies formal prayer also involves the path of the body, enhancing the meditative quality of the worship. One of the most important techniques of body meditation involves dancing. This is especially true among the Hasidic schools, where even after other meditative methods were abandoned, dance was still used as a means of attaining ecstasy and enlightenment. This, however, was not a Hasidic innovation, since even in most ancient times, dance was an important method for attaining enlightenment. The Talmud teaches that on the festival of Sukkot, Tabernacles, during the festival of drawing in Jerusalem, saints and men of deed would dance before the assemblage, holding torches and singing hymns of praise. This festival was a particularly propitious time for attaining enlightenment, as the Jerusalem Talmud states, "Why was it called a festival of drawing? Because it was a time when people drew in Ruach HaKodesh." So closely was dance associated with enlightenment that the future world, which is viewed as the ultimate place of enlightenment, is described as a dance conducted by the Blessed Holy One, where each individual points a finger at him. 3. Vocabulary. One reason why so little is known about the various systems of Kabbalah meditation is that all of this literature is in Hebrew, and it has never been accurately translated. Since most of these methods are no longer practiced, the vocabulary associated with them has also been forgotten. So great is this confusion that even the very Hebrew word for meditation is not generally known. This has even led to the use of the wrong term in an article on the subject in a major Judaic encyclopedia. Once a basic vocabulary is established, however, one can gain an appreciation of how often meditation is discussed in classical texts, particularly in the Kabbalistic classics. There is one word that is consistently used as a term for meditation by the commentators, philosophers, and Kabbalists. The word which most often denotes meditation is hitbodedut. The verb to meditate is represented by the word hitboded. The word hitboded is derived from the root badad, meaning to be secluded. Literally, then, hitbodedut actually means self-isolation, and in some cases actually refers to nothing more than physical seclusion and isolation. In many other places, however, it is used to denote a state of consciousness involving the isolation of the self, that is, the isolation of the individual's most basic essence. Thus, when discussed in a Kabbalistic context, the word hitbodedut means much more than mere physical isolation. It refers to a state of internal isolation, where the individual mentally secludes his essence from his thoughts. One of the greatest Kabbalists, Rabbi Chaim Vital, often speaks of such mental seclusion, saying that one must seclude himself, hitboded, in his thoughts to the ultimate degree. In doing this, one separates his soul from his body to such a degree that he no longer feels any relationship to his physical self. The soul is thus isolated. And as Rabbi Chaim Vital concludes, the more one separates himself from the physical, the greater will be his enlightenment. This state of mental seclusion is very important to the prophetic experience. The clearest description of this state is presented by Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, a major Jewish philosopher, often known as Gersonides or simply by the acrostic the Ralbag. He writes that the attainment of prophetic revelation requires the isolation, hitbodedut, of the consciousness from the imagination, or both of these from the other perceptive mental faculties. Rabbi Isaac of Akko also uses the same definition. Speaking of individuals seeking prophecy, he writes, "They fulfill the conditions of meditation, hitbodedut, which has the effect of nullifying the senses and divorcing the thought processes of the soul from all perception, clothing it in the spiritual essence of the transcendental." One of the clearest expressions of this has been developed by Rabbi Abraham Maimonides, son of the famed Moses Maimonides. He writes that there are two different types of self-isolation, hitbodedut, external and internal. External hitbodedut is nothing more than physical isolation, and this is usually desirable when one wishes to meditate. Internal hitbodedut, on the other hand, consists of isolating the soul from the perceptive faculty. When the mind is completely hushed in this manner, one becomes able to perceive the spiritual realm. The word hitbodedut, therefore, primarily is used to denote the isolation of the soul, or ego, from all external and internal stimuli. Any method or practice that is used to accomplish this is also called hitbodedut. Since these are the practices that are usually referred to as meditation, this is how the word hitbodedut should be translated. Another closely related term, hitboninut, is also often translated as meditation. Indeed, this is the term used in the aforementioned encyclopedia article. From context, however, we see that a more precise definition of hitbonenut is contemplation, that is, intense concentration on an object or image. Of course, contemplation is a meditative technique, but it is significant to note that the term is hardly ever used in the classical Kabbalah texts in describing the attainment of the higher states of consciousness. Chapter 2. Talmudic Mystics.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?